Starwalker Studios presents GM Intrusions, the podcast devoted to Numenera and the strange.
This episode is brought to you by the patrons of GM Intrusions. Learn how you can become a patron of the show at getjoyride.com/GM Intrusions. Episode 74 of GM Intrusions, your podcast devoted to Numenera, the Strange, and all Cypher System games. I'm your host, Lex Starwalker. Ryan Chaddick joins the show today to discuss his various Cypher System supplements. We'll also talk about creating foci, writing a third-party supplement, crowdfunding, and making a living as a creative. So grab your dice and get ready to spend some effort. It's time for a GM Intrusion. Hello, listener. Welcome back to the show. Welcome to episode 74 of GM Intrusion, season 2, going strong, kicking ass, taking names, something like that. So Ryan is back on the show today. It's been a long time, and I am just going to get into it because we had quite a good interview.
GM Intrusions Roundtable.
Ryan Chaddick joins me on the show again today. It's been a long time, Ryan. How's it going?
Pretty good. How are you?
Good. Welcome. Welcome back. I was a new green podcaster last time you were on the show, I think.
You got the skills now?
Well, I don't know about that. Definitely more experience. So, Ryan, you are Ryan Chaddick Games, pretty much, right?
Uh-huh. Well, I'm not the only one. There's a few of us.
Okay. But you have put out quite a few supplements for Numenera and now for The Strange as well. Mm-hmm. So I thought that it would be great to have you on again because you've put out a lot of stuff since we talked last. So which one do you want to talk about first? I've got a whole list of stuff you've written here.
Well, I think that interview happened, I think, when we were right in the middle of Angels and Ashes. Is that right? I think it had just come out. So that was really our third supplement, I think. Because I think I was talking about Whisper Campaigns, which is our political thing.
And that's, right, yeah.
That sold really well. It's sort of a take on Numenera, sort of bringing it into courtly life and knightly orders and sort of the interactions between these things with a real focus on kind of cutthroat politics and espionage and things like that. So, and that sold really well. It's a really, really, I mean, it still sells. It's a very successful book for us.
Awesome.
And that was, I think, our second book where we brought in my writing partner, Jordan Marshall. And he's really good at really kind of embellishing on groups and their political connections to each other. And he likes writing fiction. And so the two of us really mesh really well on this stuff. Because I have a little bit more of a foundation in sort of the mechanics and how to run the game and things like that. So I think together we're able to create something that's pretty fleshed out in most cases. That book went really well. We're getting a lot of, I got a lot of feedback from people who wanted something more in the vein of Game of Thrones, I think.
Okay.
And like something gritty and political. And we talk a lot about the difference between, I think we talked about this in the podcast, the last podcast, was it, you know, there's a difference between an adventure in which, you know, a duke sends you out to do something. I think a lot of people think that that's political,
right?
You know, like simply going to court is not political. A political game is one in which you have political motivations.
Right.
And so really that book ends up being a primer on that, on how to build a campaign around it. And a lot of that draws from my experience with Vampire.
Yes.
I'm an old Vampire the Masquerade player, and I've done about a decade of LARPing with it. So
yes, the interview is all coming back to me now. I remember that you were heavy into the live action, which is really cool.
Well, yeah, I think it's a little bit of a unique background to have. I think the stats I've seen about it are that about 1% of tabletop gamers ever really LARP. So yeah, I think it's a little bit niche, and you know, one of these days I want to publish a LARP, but it's just not a way to make money. It'd be for fun, you know. And I've actually written a LARP. We play tested it for probably 3 or 4 months. And it didn't work, so I never published it.
No.
It was bad. The premise is good, but in practice, it made people hate each other because the mechanics were designed to kind of create conflict on a level I didn't really understand at the time.
Oh, okay.
But it's good to have failures, you know.
Sure.
You can learn from them.
That's right.
So yeah, that was Whisper Campaigns, and that one's, you know, it sells pretty well, and that was one of our larger books. And then in the summer we released Echoes was before it. Sorry, we released Skyscrape, which was another one of our, in the same line as Echoes, was sort of like a series of adventures. And Skyscrape is like the idea is that there's a flying city that kind of just roams around the Ninth World, and you can plop it down kind of anywhere, and players can try and find a way to get up there and loot it and deal with the people that are still up there, and
that's
things
awesome.
Like that. And we released that the week of Gen Con, and it sold just amazingly. That's one of our shorter, cheaper, you know, just $3 books. But boy, people seem to like it. Not as much feedback on it, but it's, you know, it sells really well. So I imagine people are using it.
Yeah.
It's always hard to tell, like when people don't do reviews, you know, you don't know whether it worked for them or not. I've been really pushing for getting reviews on our stuff. And then I think after that, we wrote a Fate supplement, actually. It's called Magarchy, and it's sort of like it's a little hard to explain. It's the same way that steampunk is to cyberpunk. It's sort of like, what if there was a magical revolution during the Renaissance, and computers were invented then, and how would that impact Europe? And it's a real focus on sort of the England of Henry VIII, with, you know,
awesome
artificial intelligences and robotics and all of this fueled by magic. So it's a little on the weird side, but we're pretty proud of it, actually. It's sort of our secret kind of favorite little thing that we've made.
I wonder if the Cypher community is a little more accepting of the weird than the Fate community.
Sort of by definition than the Fate community.
Right.
No, I think, you know, to the degree that that supplement hasn't been as popular maybe as our Cypher stuff, you know, it has to do with our position within the community. Like, in the past, I've worked pretty hard to really, like, be part of the Numenera community. But also, I think we priced ourselves wrong with that supplement. We made a really big book that cost a bit more, and that really isn't what Fate, you know, people are looking for. I think they're looking for pay what you want and things like that. You know, it's good to know your market, I think, in that case. But we really wanted it. You know, every little bit that was in that book was something we needed as writers. And I really believe that game development should be thought of more as an art, an art form than a business venture, despite the fact that I'm, you know, I'm a full-time writer of this stuff. I don't have a day job. I guess it is my day job.
Yeah,
it doesn't
right.
feel like
yeah.
it. It's mostly just fun. So, but, you know, my grandfather was an artist, and I really took, I think, an ethic of sort of art being its own special thing for our culture.
Okay.
And I kind of bring that, I think, into my work with writing and illustrating, with Numenera and everything, where it's, that comes first. Which is hard, you know. I mean, sometimes you want, for instance, to really overwrite something when an adventure writes, it reads better when it's short, certain sections. So, you know, sometimes we have to really cut out a lot of stuff we'd like to see, you know, like to be there for sort of marketability or playability. you know, the same goes for length of books, you know, really. Some, if you're going to do it as print, you have to think about what kind of cost you're going to see. If you make it too big, you might price yourselves out of the market.
Right.
So, you know, it's hard to really, I mean, this is the classic problem, right? Between art, or with art, is that art and business eventually do merge, and you have to,
right.
you know,
yes.
reconcile your ideals as an artist with the demands of capitalism. But I don't know. I think we're doing okay with it. I think that we've written enough things that we've kind of found a middle ground that works for us.
Yeah, well, you are of the third-party content producers for Numenera and now The Strange. You are definitely one of the most, if not the most prolific contributors. And mm-hmm. I think it's partly because of the nature of the games, especially Numenera, where it just kind of draws in these very creative people. But it seems like we see in the community, since Numenera came out, we see so many people on the internet saying, oh, I'm gonna do a third party supplement, and I've got this great idea, and I want to get the license and get it published and everything. And I know we were talking a little bit before the show, and you just kind of touched on it about how, you know, you've been successful doing that, like being part of the community first. So do you want to talk a little bit more about that, or any advice you might have for someone out there considering trying to publish something?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so I think that, like I was just saying, my experience with Fate was a real eye-opener in that, you know, talking to people as we were working on it, it looked like we had a lot of people really interested. And certainly it sold okay. I think it was a copper bestseller.
Okay.
But, you know, it just wasn't on the level we were hoping for. And so it didn't make it cost-effective to do all the extras we wanted to do, because we wanted to do this sort of, like, tarot deck that could be played along with it, and we wanted to do a hard copy version and stuff. But, it, you know, the market just wasn't there for it. What I learned from that was, you know, you really need to be loved by the community and trusted for people to want to, you know, throw down some money into buying something. And I think that that's, I don't know that that's necessarily the problem for most people, though. I think that that's a concern, a huge concern, if you're, you know, with, say, Numenera, if you're trying to recoup, you know, the profits, you know, trying to make sure that you're actually making a profit.
Right,
you know,
right.
After paying for the license and whatever art and things like that. You know, you want to make sure you get some sales. But I don't think that that's most people's stumbling block. I think that usually it's that, like, self-publishing takes so many skills.
Right.
That's really the thing you have to think about. I mean, for me, I wanted to self-publish games my whole life, but I didn't have any conception of how to get art for a price that would be reasonable, that would work. So for me, it was always the art, and I still grapple with that a little bit. I've yet to pay for art for
awesome.
Any of our books.
Awesome.
I produce it myself, partly with photo manipulations of Creative Commons images, and partly just sort of stuff that I make. You know, because I've over the years developed some, you know, Photoshop type skills. So I do my own cartography, for instance. But in the future, I'm going to be moving into sort of grabbing up, you know, professional artists. But, you know, I think that'll be for further down the road. You know, I really admire Andreas Walters, for instance, for the art that he picks. Like, his books are really beautiful.
Yeah, yeah.
It just, for me, that would never be, I don't think they would be cost effective.
Like, right.
I don't think I could live off of what we're doing, you know, because right now that's what I'm doing. My roommate and I are both, you know, splitting the profits on this stuff, and that's how we pay the rent. And so we just wouldn't be there if we had to pay for art. But, you know, in the future, if I do a Kickstarter or something, we'll be able to afford a little bit more professional stuff.
And right.
That's what I'm looking for. Not that I think that our stuff is terrible. I think that if you look at our books, they look pretty good.
Definitely. Yeah. And I know in the last interview, you talked about how you create a lot of the images and art in your supplements. Mm-hmm. And knowing that, and then going and looking through them at what you've done, like, I've been very impressed with what you come up with. You come up with some really cool images, and that's awesome.
Thanks. I mean, when we were sort of planning this stuff out, what we realized was not only that Creative Commons images are out there, but that since most of them are photographs, you know, sort of manipulating those photographs made art that wasn't seen in most role-playing games. Like, most of the time, people are paying for artists, like
right.
line art and you know, watercolors and regular digital art.
Right.
But, you know, you're not seeing a lot of photographs. And so we figured that, you know, what a cool way to get inexpensive art is to sort of take, you know, stuff that already is pretty high resolution and sometimes very cool looking and move it into something a little bit more fitting whatever setting by using manipulations.
Yeah.
And that what was great with that was that it gave me the ability to really control color. And I don't know if you can tell, but I'm sort of obsessed with color. Sort of like, by like all of our books have a color theme.
Okay.
And I always want them to really kind of bring you in. The same goes for, you know, the brushes we use in the digital stuff. It's all, I kind of go through and develop an art style for the whole book before we even start it. Sometimes even before writing, we develop sort of what's the color scheme and what's the kind of the style of art we're going to do and what are the brushes we're going to use to manipulate things. And I develop a few techniques and then we move into sort of the rest of the book. And for me, theme and kind of a coherent style is really important.
Yeah, I don't know much about, actually, I know nothing about art. My wife is an artist, but for instance, I'm looking at an image from the translation codex right now that I really like, which it's in the very beginning, and it's just this bird like sitting on a branch, and I don't know.
Oh, I love it. Yeah.
I don't know how much you manipulated that, but to me, it looks like, you know, this photograph of a bird almost like it's in a painting or something. And like mm-hmm. everything except for the bird is kind of out of focus and kind of surreal. And it's just, you come up with some really cool stuff.
Well, you know, that photograph is like that's only a piece of the photograph and the rest of it's really blurry.
Okay.
So I didn't think it was going to work. It looks like a bad photograph, but you know, I cut it down and colored it and kind of blurred some things some more. Sometimes, you know, doing digital blurring can actually make real blur like look better. And
cool.
And yeah, that one's it's kind of a combination of a really great piece of a photograph and then with a lot of kind of manipulation. But yeah, that's one of my favorite pictures that we've done, honestly. I love that one.
I really like that stuff because, I mean, I'm very much into realism. My wife and I mm-hmm. saw an art exhibit recently that was like modern, like ultra realism, like just things blown up to a ridiculous scale. And like, I loved it and she knew I would. And but for me, when I'm looking at art in a role-playing game, like I'm looking for things that I can show the players, like this is what you see, you know? And
right.
So I really prefer something like that. That's like photorealistic as opposed to the really cartoony art that you see in a lot of RPGs where it's like, well, obviously this isn't what you see because it's a cartoon unless you're playing Tune, you know?
Right.
So I think that that's actually, you know, a strength of doing something like this is it looks much more like what the character would actually see.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that, you know, necessity was the mother of invention in our case, where it was like we literally did not have the money to pay for art. So I had to find something else. And we found this weird thing where photography isn't being used, you know, very much. And so why not play with that?
Yeah.
And I found a lot of Creative Commons digital art as well. So if you like look at Whisper Campaigns, for instance, there's a number of like actual pieces of art that people did, and that, you know, oftentimes they're sort of people's preliminary sketches for other pieces of art they're making.
Right, right.
And they've happened to put them up under Creative Commons, and I'm able to sort of use them. I'm moving more and more into finding 3D art. And so for the book we're about to release, we'll be using some of that. We're working on a book called Broken Immersion for The Strange, and it's sort of a look at the massive multiplayer, you know, role-playing game side of Arden,
yes.
Which is, you know, the uploaded code of an MMORPG.
Right.
And because for me, the core book doesn't touch on that enough.
No.
You know, the core book presents it more as a fantasy setting than like as a game setting.
Right.
Besides the artifacts, which are very, very like true to games. So I wanted to expand on that because I'm an MMO person, or I have been, And I really wanted to explore all of the sort of tropes right. and ideas that you get from it. What would that mean within a recursion, you know?
Yep.
People descended from characters that were pre-programmed or objects that exist in the world that can't be destroyed because they're quest items or, you know, pieces of the original code that have sort of melded with the ciphers, which are code of Arden, or pardon me, code of the Strange. And so they're like, you know, command line commands that are functional still and, you know, things like that. We've written three dungeons that are essentially instances. They're like mini recursions that are attached to Arden. And so you can go into them and they work just like recursions, or they work just like instances, but then they have their own rules because they're recursions and the creatures within them are sort of isolated from the rest of the world. And sometimes they're halfway programmed. So very it's cool. kind of a weird supplement.
If you can just get Arden to recognize you as a dev or a GM, it's on.
Yeah, we have a whole chapter on it.
That's awesome.
So like there's one, you know, there's a focus for being a level designer and one for being a customer service rep.
That's awesome.
You know, things like that. And it's because you have a little bit of access to some of their original commands or, you know, things like that. So you can, you know, like move objects in the world or, you know, save people, help people. Things like that. And then we have a chapter that's about sort of being a player. Awesome. So we have a little bit more access to the play styles that are inherent in normal MMOs, sort of the like tank, healer, damager type stuff.
Right.
They tie a little bit in with what the intended classes were. The idea is that Arden recognizes you as a player when you enter, when you translate uh-huh. in. And you, so you can sort of pick a class and a race and play like a player. So, I don't know. It's kind of fun. I don't know if it's for everybody. I don't know if there are, if the Numenera fan is necessarily the same as a MMO player, but it is for me, so I'm making it. I don't care.
I personally am very much looking forward to it. Like, I have kind of a meh response to Arden, and the one thing about Arden that actually interests me is the fact that it's based on an MMO. And I know when I was in the playtest and we were playtesting The Dark Spiral and we went to Arden and I was just having a blast with that because I was like, my character was a Brash Vector. And so every time we were standing around talking to people, like I made sure and made everybody know that I was jumping up and down constantly and like spinning in circles. Nice. And it was like, there was like one guy in the group that played MMOs and he like got it. And everybody else is like, what is wrong with you?
Yeah. When I ran during the playtest for The Strange, when I had my players, you know, they accidentally find this portal to Arden and they go there. And the first thing they run into is, you know, like a Sword in the Stone type, like epic quest line that's built into the world. And you know, the things around it are designed to interact with it correctly. So, you know, there are literally people who have sort of scripted things they say, and yeah. there's nothing they can do but kind of push that plot forward as though it were like a planned out plot line. So, and all of my players are MMO players, so it worked out perfectly. We had a lot of fun
that's
with
awesome.
That. But yeah, I think that's an element of Arden that's not quite embellished, like as extremely as they could.
Right.
So I can't wait to sort of see what people do with it.
I know. I can't wait to give like someone the fetch quest, like go kill 10 right. wolves and bring me their canines so that I can make this potion to bring my husband right. back from the dead. And
yeah. Well, I think referencing the trope is funny, but then on top of that, like, what I like to do is think about what are the implications of all that stuff. Like, the pre-programmed characters, the NPCs of the world, were probably the original population of Arden when it gets created. But during the, like, 2 or 3 year period when it's cut off from the world, when Arden was first created,
mm-hmm.
it experienced almost 200 years
right.
of its own recursive time. So that means that the people that exist in Arden today are not the original programmed NPCs. They're descendants.
Right.
So my thought is, like, what does that mean? Do they have, like, scripts that are passed down genetically to them? That, like, if you see someone with this sword, you are supposed to say this one certain thing and push them in the direction of going to this one land? Or,
right.
you know, what happened to all those quest items? And you know, does the world, like, one of the things we talk about with the instances is, like, the world is programmed to make sure you get a certain amount of loot. So, like, what if the people of the world realize this? And so they go into those instances to sort of harvest artifacts.
Right.
And what kind of weirdos are they? Like, I mean, it makes it so you fully understand in some, or at least better understand the Betrayer, because the Betrayer was a human,
right,
like a programmer,
right,
who gets pulled in and becomes the God of War. Well, of course he thinks of the people within Arden as just playthings.
Right.
They're programs.
Right.
Like, they're AIs that he wrote, potentially. And so to him, they're not real. And maybe they aren't real. I mean, The Strange is a giant computer.
Right.
Everything in it is just a simulation. So in a sense, they kind of aren't.
Right.
But then what is real? I mean, does it matter whether right. something is made of atoms or electrons, you know?
Right. Yeah.
So I think it's kind of cool. It pulls up all these sort of philosophical questions, but also allows you to sort of, it humanizes the bad guy a little bit in
sure.
a sense. And it makes so players can think in those terms as well. I mean, like, if you could kill the same person over and over again with the chance of gaining an artifact, would you do it? You know, players have that kind of available, I guess. So I don't know. I think it's kind of, I think MMOs actually really stretch the boundaries of realism and,
oh, definitely,
and narrative, because they're games and not stories. So I think that playing with those and what the implications of that are is really kind of fun.
I think another question that's interesting is what happened with all the bugs in that time, because I've never played an MMO without bugs. So
right, yeah, we deal with that a lot. I mean, like, I introduce an alternate race that's not finished, and there's a lot of bugs in the instances because they weren't finished, and we talk about that. You know, to me, that's one of the more interesting elements.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, a few of our ciphers, you know, cause problems. You can accidentally fall through the world, and
that's like awesome. I'm gonna love this supplement.
I'm glad I'm not the only one.
Well, and I think that, like you say, it's something that's probably overlooked by some people, especially people that don't play MMOs or haven't. And it's definitely not really focused on in the book at all, other than this is how Arden came to be. But I think you can have a lot of fun with that any players at your table that have played MMOs are just going to love.
Sure, yeah. Well, and it opens up all those kind of weird storylines and implications and characters. I mean, you know, imagine playing a character that's from Arden that actually is, you know, the descendant of an NPC or a player character or something weird like that, you know, or grows up with Arden thinking that they are a GM, right? So, like, they can see the command line at the top of their
right.
you know, vision, or, like, things they say sometimes get recognized as commands, and so they happen. Such a cool way to play a paradox or whatever.
Definitely.
So yeah, I don't know. I guess the only book I've done we haven't really talked about is Translation Codex.
Yes.
That's our only Strange book out right now. So yeah, is it okay if I talk about that one?
Yeah, and tell us, I know there's kind of a cool story that goes along with that too.
Yeah, so I realized early on in the playtest that the number of foci in the core book in total really are, you know, about equivalent to Numenera.
Right, right.
But when you're talking about each individual world, you know, Arden, Rook, and Earth, it was pretty clear that weren't going to be enough.
Yeah.
You know, it just wasn't quite enough foci. And I knew that they would be coming out with books with more foci. But for me, because I had played The Strange several times, it was kind of a problem because, like, the party makeup was the same, you know?
Right.
Each time it was like, oh, of course we've got the cop and we've got the criminal and we've got the spy. Like, it happened again. And so, like, I was like, I need to fix this. People are going to need something to fix this. And the other thing I realized was that recursions, because you can have custom foci for each recursion, you're going to need, you know, the foci to fill that in. And while Numenera provides a ton, and that's really, I think what they intended you to do was sort of pull a few from Numenera and
right.
from other recursions and kind of put something together, I realized that it would be really useful to have a book that that provided, you know, a lot of foci in all kinds of different settings. So it just so happened that I was moving to Indiana. You know, my wife had gotten accepted in a grad program out here in Bloomington, and we were moving out with our roommate Jordan, and who's Jordan Marshall, my co-author on a lot of this stuff. So it was just me and Catherine, my wife, who's also our layout person and editor, and Jordan all driving in the car. And, you know, we're making these books normally. And so we were like, well, why don't we write a book on the way? So we were hauling a lot of stuff. So ended up being a 6-day trip. So over the course of 6 days, we basically outlined all of these foci, and we wrote 100 of them. And boy, it was an amazing experience, because like we would do them one kind of setting at a time.
Okay.
And so, you know, we wrote all of the psionic stuff while we were in Nevada. And we wrote a lot of the low fantasy stuff in Utah, and you know, things like that. Like there's very all cool. This for me, there's a geographical correspondence,
yeah,
for every focus, you know, like I can remember, you know, because I was driving, so all of it's very visual for me.
That's awesome.
So that, you know, now the United States is this like map of powers to my mind, and weird settings and things. And it was really a weird experience, because, you know, I've written a lot of foci over the years, like in the last year, especially for like our Angels and Ashes book, you know, and I wrote a little article about how to do that, because I felt like I had a lot more experience than most people in it. And I really think that writing foci is pretty easy. That's actually my sort of takeaway for people.
Okay.
Is that it's easier than you think, but just don't go crazy.
Like right.
writing a power is hard in that you need to write it with as few words as possible. That's the only thing I can say.
Yeah. Like,
just make it short. That's how you can make it good. But it was such a different way of doing it, because normally you write the rules for something. But instead, because I was driving and I'm the kind of rules person in the car, we didn't write any rules. We just wrote the ideas kind of for each level.
Okay.
Kind of vaguely what a power would be. And in some cases, we talk about what, you know, what skill you might pick up at different levels. So really, the Translation Codex, which is a book of just 100 foci, you know, with some recursions that we wrote, and not to mention some fiction from Jordan, which I think are pretty good. Like, it's, I don't know how to say it. Like, it's not about the rules. It's sort of about these cool, iconic, like, archetypes
right.
that you can be. But at the same time, there's 15 per sort of broad genre, you know, and we do both high and low fantasy, and you could easily use the psionic ones with those as well. So, you know, in a sense, there's a lot there, but I've actually gotten a little bit of criticism on it, that people were saying that some of these foci were not powerful, and I think that they were taking it from a sort of a combat perspective.
Right.
And for me, Cypher System is not about combat, and foci, while they can be combat-focused, aren't always supposed to be about, like, making sure that you're... Like, for me, it's the types that provide combat abilities.
Mm-hmm.
And the foci are more about style and just like really taking the sort of raw elements of the descriptor and the type and making that into a cool character.
Yeah.
You know, and obviously the various combinations of type, descriptor, and then, you know, adding the focus on as the icing, like those are what make things very unique. Like, you know, any given focus is quite different given a different type, but like, really, it's the focus that gives something, you know, real, like, a flavor and a direction and a motivation and a place in the world. So, for me, those are, like, really important in the fact that those are so much more showcased in The Strange, because you get to swap them out. It was a lot of fun to write them. And, you know, a few of them we didn't write on the trip. I ended up writing at home. And, you know, once I got here... And in particular, this sort of miscellaneous chapter. So one of them, the one that everybody always talks about whenever they write a review is Dyes.
Yeah.
Which is the like Star Trek red shirt thing.
Right, right.
And I realized after writing it that it works for like a World War II story, or especially a World War I story.
Sure.
You know, or any story where there's a lot of people dying.
Yeah.
You know, it's sort of like... Why are these people dying all the time? Well, here's the explanation. It's actually a player character who's helping everyone else. But anyway, that was one where I wrote it, you know, in the middle of the night, and I went out and woke up my wife. I was just so excited to have written it, because it was such a weird idea. And so I'm very happy that other people picked up on it and like care, because it's not just like some Star Trek joke, which it is, but like it all. I mean, I think it actually could work as a thing to play. So I don't know. Kind of a funny, just a funny exploration of the mechanics, because the idea is, you know,
yeah,
every time you die, you retranslate in to that recursion with full, like, might pool, but all your other pools are where they were before. So, you know, or I think they start at one. But, like, I think it's an interesting way to go with it. And, the narrator of that supplement talks about how it's a form of immortality, but it's the worst form. You have to die all the time.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. It was a fun book to write, though. I mean, we really got to kind of go out and, you know, on some limbs. I got to explore some literary ideas about sort of like, you know, Campbell's idea of the hero's journey. Yeah. We explore and you know, with the ones where we only wrote five foci, we did five of those in the miscellaneous chapter. I really got to sort of like figure out what are the five core sort of concepts or like bare minimum foci that you would need in that type of world. And we ended up throwing out a lot of ideas. Like, I really wanted to do just a fairy tale one. And at one point we were planning out just a Land of Oz one, because that was already in the Strange Book, and we were thinking about, like, how would you do foci in that and, you know, things like that. But not everything made the cut. 100-page book is already pretty – I mean, 100 – focus book is already, you know, going to end up pretty long. So,
well, kids, maybe one day there'll be a volume two.
Boy, I don't want to think about it. It was amazing, the process of writing, because I was writing about a dozen, doing the actual writing of a dozen foci a day.
Wow.
When we did it, when I finally, you know, went back through to actually put some rules down so we could test them.
Right.
And go through them, but like a dozen foci in a day is a lot.
Yes, that is a lot.
You know, that's about 6,000 words, which is about as many as I can write in one day. And it drains you.
I'll bet.
The prospect of doing it again, boy. I think. I've gone through this recently. You know, same goes for when you write oddity lists. Like, if you write one oddity list, you're like, whoa, that was cool. I actually made it all the way through. But writing two oddity lists, you're like, I don't know if I can do this again. This is hard. Like, first of all, oddity lists, I don't know if you've ever tried.
No, I haven't. But I'm sure it's very difficult without repeating yourself.
It is seriously the hardest part of writing for Numenera. And the reason is that, like, when you're writing a focus, that takes 6 or 7 good ideas.
Right.
And if you're writing an oddity list, it takes 100.
Yeah.
Like, 100 good ideas just is a lot to write.
And
like,
weird good ideas, too, you know?
Oh, yeah, it is so hard. I mean, actually, the difficult part is not just the idea. It's putting it into a sentence that's short enough. Because it's easy to be like, oh, well, there's this thing, and if you slide one thing, it does this, and if you slide another, it does this, right, and it glows, and this is sort of what I'm intending. But, like, you don't have the room to do that, and if you did, nobody would like your oddities. Like, it's got to be one sentence with maybe a couple pieces to it, and, boy, that's not easy.
I imagine,
To write well, it's hard, and then to do that 100 times. Because I've been recently writing, because the new edition of Dungeons & Dragons has trinkets.
And yes, I love those.
Almost exactly the same thing as oddities, they're just not as weird.
Yep.
And they're a little bit toned down in terms of, you know, what they do. But I wrote 2 trinket lists last week, and it's just, like, absolutely draining as a writer. Just amazing how it... Like 200 ideas, takes out of you just how many hours have to go into that.
Sure.
So, I don't know. It's interesting.
Well, one thing I just want to highlight real quick that you kind of mentioned, and we talked a little bit about, you know, things to consider if you're thinking about putting out a supplement. And, like, there's so much that goes into it that someone may not realize if they've never done anything like that before. And to me, and kind of the part that I kind of slacked on a little bit when I was thinking about my own supplement is thinking about all those parts and how you're going to get all that done. And so you mentioned your roommate Jordan is doing a lot of writing for you, and then your wife is doing editing and layout.
Right.
You know, and then you're doing the rules. So, you know, right there, you've got a lot of those bases covered. And it's like, for me, like, I can write, I can edit, but that's about, you know, where it ends for me, you know?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, like, I took a seminar at Gen Con this year sort of talking about this. And really the thing that they were emphasizing was, and I wish I could remember who I can, the speaker off the top of my head, and I can't, but what they were really emphasizing was the need as a small publisher to wear every hat almost.
Right.
And that's been the, I mean, because when we first started, I was doing the layout, and my wife was just doing the editing, and then she learned InDesign, and, you know, I bought a book for that, and she studied that when we had a week off from working, and so, you know, the, like, that was really crucial to sort of us moving into that next big step, because Microsoft Word, first of all, isn't very good for formatting,
right?
But then will not produce the PDFs you need to do print on demand.
Right.
And so there's this big leap to you need to take from doing things in something like Word to moving into InDesign, which is really the industry standard, right, for layout.
Yeah.
So that was really different. Ironically, like, POD isn't a big moneymaker. I think people should know that going into it. Mm. If anybody's thinking about it, like, we sell maybe, you know, between 3 and 5 POD copies of any given book that we write. So, and remember, you have to send 3 copies to MCG. So, in the end, it's really not very cost effective. Like, it's not actually profitable to do POD for me, but we still do it for some books, because we want hard copies ourselves.
And you have to do a separate layout for that as well, right?
Well, see, that's yeah, it's not that different. You really just, the bleed on the edges is just different a little bit.
Right.
The main difference is that you have to do, boy, this is getting technical.
It's all right.
In order to do in order to print it, you have to limit the black levels on your images.
Okay.
So, so that becomes a thing, and then there's the bleed. So you have to do a separate version for with limited black levels and they have the bleed.
Yeah. Well, I guess my point is if you're having to pay someone by the hour to do your layout, then that's going to add a lot to your cost to have to do 2 layouts, even if the second one is just, you know, kind of reformatting the first one a little bit.
Yeah, and I think that, I think that I've never really considered paying someone to do it, right, in the same way that I've never paid anyone for art. I just never, you know, I want to start from scratch and learn it from the beginning and know every aspect of what we're doing and of the publishing industry, or at least the game publishing industry. Like, I want to be doing as much as I can. So, it, you know, and obviously we're working on a shoestring budget here, but, and so that's a pretty major part of it. But, you know, as someone who wants to be a professional, if I'm not already, who wants to sort of move up in this industry over the next 5 or 10 years, like, I think it's worth, you know, doing everything kind of in-house if I can to sort of be, you know, really within that process.
Yeah. Well, you kind of have to.
Exactly. And that's what sort of that seminar that I went to was talking about. It's like, if you've got a small fortune, you know, you can do whatever you want to do. You can pay people to do all of it, but at a certain point, you're not the creator.
Yeah.
And I think that a lot of us who go into wanting to create these kinds of things have one specific thing we can do, and usually it's sort of being a creator.
The idea man.
Well, and that's a problem, right? I mean, like, I can't tell you how many sort of, like, 'cause most role-playing game companies don't accept, you know, unsolicited pitches,
right,
even,
right,
let alone manuscripts or whatever.
Right.
Like, they're not interested, and part of it's that most people think of themselves as idea people. I mean, that's what makes us role players.
And that's the easy part. So,
and that's what?
The easy part of that, coming up with an idea, anybody can do that. That's the easy part.
Yeah. And that's not to say that every idea is good, but I think that by definition, being a role player means that you're imaginative.
Right.
And being a role player also usually means that you're smart, and so you've got a certain level of confidence about your ideas.
Sure.
But being able to write those ideas is really a skill. And I think that I think we all know that. I think we've all read good and bad things, and we can see that there's a pretty wide variation in terms of experience. But I think all of us intuitively want to be creators, because that's really what, you know, especially those of us who GM or DM, it's like, I'm a creator. Like, why can't I do this for a living?
Right.
And to be honest, I never thought I was going to be able to do it for a living with this stuff. And even now, we're kind of just barely making enough of a profit that I don't have to have a day job. But like, it's hard, and you really should put in the hours and learn the whole thing, and I think be aware that you'll have to wear some other hats.
Yes.
When we first started putting books together, it wasn't for Numenera; it was for my little LARP group. Sort of based out of our university, and you know, we were doing layout in Microsoft Word, and that was what we figured out how to do. And so that's how we started doing Numenera books, was that we were like, oh, this is how you can do a background, and this is how you can kind of border things, and I guess we can try and publish something, since we were allowed to save as a PDF on this and put that up. But of course, that's not quite enough to really make something look professional. But it gets your foot in the door, and like, so little things like that can add up. Like the fact that I had some cartography skills from several years of trying to make my own campaigns, you know, just for home use, that ended up being crucial. But those were just the seeds of what I needed to sort of get these books going. It takes a lot. Like having gone to college helped me in terms of being able to write to a deadline, and that's really been pretty crucial, you know, things like that.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, and the thing is like, well, let's take editing for an example, because everybody's going to need an editor. Even if you're the best writer on the planet, you still need an editor. And so, you know, you have some options, right? You can go find a professional editor to edit for you, in which case it's going to cost you a lot of money. Or if you have connections and maybe you know a professional editor who will do it for you on the cheap, or maybe you sort of know one that you can show them what you're doing and they'll get really excited about it and do it on the cheap. If you don't have those connections, then it's basically, well, you either hire a pro to do it and you're going to really pay for it, or you find someone that will do it for cheap, but then they're not a professional editor, and they may be a great editor or they may not be. And like every aspect of the project is like that. It's like, well, you either do it yourself, or then you have these options of, well, I either get a pro to do it and I pay for it, or maybe I'm lucky and I have a connection, or then I'm going to find someone I can afford, but then it may not end up being what I really want.
Yeah. And I think that taken as a whole, sort of outside of just editing, there's a couple different ways of thinking of it with this kind of stuff, where it's like, one way to think of it is that there's a lot of different decisions like that you really have to make, and therefore you have to kind of figure out where you are,
right?
Whether you're a professional yet, or, you know, how critical people are going to be of your stuff since you're just new to it. I think that people are pretty forgiving when it's your first few books. But at the same time, I think the other way to look at it is, boy, we have more options now as people trying to jump into this industry than we have ever had. You know, it continues to baffle me that we are allowed to do this. I mean, growing up, I never thought I was going to get to actually be able to write role-playing games. It seemed impossible.
Right.
Like, there was no, how the heck would you learn to do that? there's no school for that. There's no entry-level positions you could find.
Right.
It can't be done. Whereas now we're in a situation that's vastly different from even a few years ago. You know, if you look at the way POD works on DriveThruRPG, I mean, I can put up books. That's crazy.
Yep.
Like from home, just put together a book. You know, we live in a weird world where you're allowed to do that. And so, I mean, the fact that we're able to choose between, like, you know, I know editors that'll work really cheap and they have less experience, and I know editors that cost a lot more and that have a lot of experience, and my wife costs nothing.
Right.
You know, so, I mean, there's a lot of different levels to sort of choose from. And I mean, I guess with editing, the advice is don't be your own editor.
No,
that's not real. That's not an actual editor.
You will miss so many things.
Yeah. You just have to have someone else being there for you.
Well, I know as a writer, you know, like let's say I'm writing a novel, you know, the kind of the accepted advice is I finish my novel, I put it in a drawer for at least a month, and then I go back and start doing my first revision, because, you know, I have enough distance now that at least I will see some of the mistakes I wouldn't have seen before. But even then, it's still something I wrote, and there are going to be mistakes that I just don't see because my mind knows what I meant, you know, and you still sure. have to, after you've revised it a few times yourself, you still got to send it to an editor. And usually, you know, you have a, you know, different editors that do different levels of editing on it. You know, there's not just one editor that does it all.
Yeah. I mean, there's a big difference between a copy editor and a content editor.
Right. Right. And
but,
a proofreader.
I mean, for me at my level, it's more like I know certain things. Like I will catch certain types of errors.
Right. Right.
And my wife will catch certain types of errors, and they're not necessarily the same. We don't necessarily catch the same things. And so, two sets of eyes are going to catch way more.
Definitely. You know? Definitely.
So that's just, for me, the more eyes on anything. And the same goes for rules. I have used my friends, my old playtest group, and my, you know, for rules, because so much, like even for rules that I don't have time, you know, translation codex, there was no way we were going to get to playtest every one of the 100 foci. Like it can't be done.
Right.
But, you know, having other eyes on it is critical, because you need, one person can't notice everything, and every person's experience is different. So yep. It's really important to get, you know, have a community that sort of pulls together for any given thing you're working on.
Yep.
I would say.
So have a plan. That's the bottom line.
Yeah. I mean, it's critical. At my level, we, you know, where we're sort of, you know, producing a book a month, probably maybe a little more, a book every month and a half, we absolutely have to have a plan, a pretty careful plan. But that's mostly, honestly, it's mostly for writing. But it helps you sort of cycle through the other parts of it, you know, because you know when you're going to finish a chapter, and then you can move that over to getting that edited or getting it to the playtesters or whatever. So, yeah. Boy, this has turned into just talking about advice for third-party people.
Yeah. Well, I know there's a lot of people out there that want to do it and are considering it. So you are one of the most experienced as far as Numenera.
Sure. Yeah.
and you, I know you've had at least one of your supplements has hit the sales cap, Celestial Wisdom, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we're getting close on another one of ours, so we'll probably have to re-up that one. But yeah, Celestial Wisdom was interesting. So first of all, that's one that we originally did the layout in Word, like I said, although now I think our layout is a version that we've converted over into InDesign. So it's two column rather than one column format and things like that. Because I just wasn't getting two column format to work in Word.
Oh, that's
very
a pain.
Well. you know, this, it just, yeah, there's just so many little problems.
Yeah.
But, you know, I decided not to re-up the license and instead just leave it for free because, you know, it was my beginning work. And for me, it's not at the level I want to be, you know, charging money for, I guess. So that one, it's so funny. We sell probably three copies of Celestial Wisdom for free, not really selling,
right?
A day. so it's as popular as it's ever been.
Oh, definitely. Hardly a week goes by that I don't see someone say something about it online, like even today.
It's amazing. it's so ironic because I was going to put out all of that content for free. I was writing it up and then the license came out and I was like, well, pick up a license. Let's publish this.
Yeah.
And so that's why I was able to publish it, I think, 2 weeks after I picked up the license, because it was all, you know, I just needed to do the art and a few sections.
Now, was that the first Numenera limited license product?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it definitely was.
Yeah.
Translation Codex might be the first strange one. I'm not sure, because Andreas put out one for pre-order.
Okay.
And then he released it after we did Translation Codex. I'm not sure if I had both licenses first, but yeah, I think that was an interesting experience being the first Numenera one, because I got contacted by so many people and got to do some interviews and things like that, where people seemed really excited about Numenera and wanted to see, you know, because I think these licenses have been a little controversial and things like that. So.
A little bit. We won't go into that, though.
Yeah.
So one last thing I wanted to ask you, Ryan.
Sure.
And we kind of talked about this a little bit before the show, but how you feel about kind of the state of the Cypher system right now and what's happening with the system?
Yeah. The system is, I mean, it's at a really interesting place now, right?
Yeah.
Because we've got the Cypher, you know, sort of core system coming out this summer. Mm-hmm. I can't remember the terminology for the book, but, you know, we've got that coming out this summer, and obviously we've got, you know, the Shotguns and Sorcery book, you know, is finishing up its Kickstarter right now.
Yeah.
You know, so there's licensing opportunities for people going beyond just Numenera and the Strange. So I think we're in really a really cool place with the entire system, right?
Yeah.
Where they, you know, they help each other, and you can use monsters and foci from each other in the recursions or in Numenera. So this thing is just a big recursive sort of feedback loop of sort of resources.
Yeah.
So in that sense, it's a really weird role-playing game to be involved in, and it's such an exciting time. You know, and the system really breaks a lot of boundaries and works very differently than most games. I mean, it's easy to compare Numenera to a dungeon crawl type game, but it really has a totally different emphasis than a D&D game, and the mechanics are quite different. That it's its own, you know, weird thing, and it really goes out on a limb when you're talking about the, you know, pools, for instance, being your hit points. And the way difficulty levels work and how simple those are in some ways, but also, you know, is kind of interesting math when you're actually at the table, and how fast combat works, and therefore it de-emphasizes combat sometimes and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm very excited to be part of Numenera. And honestly, it's afforded me this incredible opportunity to get to enter the industry. And so I'm hugely, hugely, you know, indebted to Morning Cook Games for... and kind of giving me that opportunity, giving all of us that opportunity. So I think it's a beautiful system. I'm very happy to be part of it. And there's a lot, you know, I'm always excited to see where things go with it. That's the beauty of Kickstarter. You know, and Numenera is obviously built on Kickstarter in that sense. I think I'm definitely going to do one for something this year.
Awesome.
Just because we live in this amazing era of crowdfunding and creativity. You know, where people are willing to buy PDFs of things. And
right.
I mean, all of these things coming together, POD being available. It's just, we live in this like perfect storm of creativity. So, I mean, who can pass that up?
Yeah, I've been thinking I should really get on the Kickstarter boat and do one for the studio.
Sure. Well, and you've got a Patreon, and I think that's a really, I'd love to talk to you at some point about that. Like it's, Patreon's another amazing thing. I see so many artists able to finally do what they want to do,
yeah,
because of Patreon.
Yeah,
it's just, that's, we live in a crazy awesome time with these things coming out all the time and people starting to trust in them, you know.
Yeah, the guys at Patreon actually believe, I don't know if it's true, I'd like to believe it myself, that there's this emerging new class of the, I think they call it the creative class.
Mm-hmm.
Where, you know, these days you can be a creative, whether it's, you know, a podcaster or a writer or an artist, and you know, connect directly with your fans and your customers and have them support you directly and be successful in a way that, you know, you never could before. It was, you know, the 1% of the 1% that could actually make a living as an artist or a writer or a musician or anything like that. And it's kind of interesting.
Sure. Yeah. I'm not really sure. It'll be interesting to see whether it's, in some ways, it might be sort of the answer to the problems we see with art. I mean, like, the music industry,
right,
is constantly producing less and less artists, you know, promoting less and less artists. Mm-hmm. With albums. And they're under their own special financial constraints there. But, I mean, one could say that the bigger the business, the more it kind of edges out little independent voices. And so I think Patreon, for instance, is an answer to that. And certainly being able to buy individual songs on, you know, iTunes or whatever, and
right.
sort of the way YouTube works, where you can do advertising, like all of these different models are just a beautiful way to find art again in our culture.
Right, right.
Because I really think that if we're not making art, then our culture isn't really worth anything, you know, in a lot of ways. So I think that finding these little ways, I mean, you know, so DriveThruRPG for me is the way I do it. Kickstarter, hopefully in the future, and maybe even Patreon. I'm seeing a lot of, you know, web artists, for instance, web comic artists really seem to be doing well on Patreon and Kickstarter and things like that. I think that's amazing.
Yeah. And the great thing about it is it kind of gets rid of the middleman, because it's like in publishing in the past, you know, you had to find a publisher. And so you had this very small number of people who were deciding what everybody gets to read and what's good and what's not good. And nowadays, you know, more and more authors are breaking out, publishing themselves. And so now, you know, now it's up to the consumer. They get to decide, oh, I like this podcast, or oh, I like this game designer, or oh, I like this artist or author. And so I'm going to support them. And so right. the end user gets to decide what's good and what's not, instead of, you know, some guys in suits in New York, you know, which is
sure,
awesome.
Sure. I mean, there's a reciprocal problem with that, right? I mean, where it's right. that, you know, finding what's good is hard, and there will eventually probably be sort of middlemen type things for, I mean, even the concept of content aggregation, right? That's what that is.
Right, right.
People who go out and find cool things and show it to you. That's on a website you can look at.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that smart, insightful critique, and, you know, I think that's a hugely important element of it. So,
yes.
You know, I think podcasts, for instance, that can really go in depth into what's good and what's not and what's happening, are an interesting middle ground there, where they're able to help people kind of find what's good. Because, you know, I find that I'm my own promotion team for
yes.
all the things I write. And so, and since I don't really differentiate between my company and myself very much, that means that I can't be a jerk on the internet very much anymore.
Yeah, yeah, you got to be careful.
That's a lot of pressure. It's pressure, you know, when I'm on Reddit and somebody's, you know, criticizing something I wrote and put up for free, I have to remember, oh, well, I can't just be like, well, you know, take your money and go, but you didn't spend anything, so just go. I mean, I can't say that, because it's like, well, these are my consumers, and the internet is a fairly permanent record, and,
yep.
you know, I'm supposed to be I'm basically this merchant out on the street corner, and I've got a reputation to protect, and that's everything. So,
yeah.
you know, and I don't want a bad boy reputation. There's enough jerks on the internet.
Yes.
So
too many.
So that's very difficult. I think as an artist, where I have to constantly be doing customer service, and it's hard to differentiate between, you know, real relationships and sort of interactions with customers.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, that's the breaks for getting to do what I love. So
yeah.
it's worth it, I think.
Well, I know what you mean. It may shock people to hear this, but I'm actually a fairly opinionated person. And I have to bite my tongue so many times, because it's like, well, I can't, like you said, I can't just go online and say whatever the hell I want anymore.
Yeah. Not anymore.
So
you just hope people don't find when you were opinionated
yeah.
online.
Yeah, there's some stuff out there. I don't know. I'm sure I'd hear about it if people found it.
Right. But yeah. Same with me.
Luckily, my wife is great for that. I get to say all the things to her that I can't say publicly.
Right.
And then she's like, you know, you probably shouldn't say that.
It's like we're all, you know, politicians on the campaign trail.
Right.
Basically.
That never ends.
Right. Yeah.
Yep. Well, Ryan, thanks so much for coming on the show again. I really appreciate it. Lots of good stuff.
Sure. Very fun.
Do you have any parting words?
I hope everybody who's a creative person out there finds a community of creative people to work together on these things and doesn't have to wear all the hats.
Yeah.
I think that that's what'll end up leading to success, or at least art, which is, you know, success enough for a lot of us.
Right. Awesome. And how can people find you online and find your work?
You can always find me on Google+ as Ryan Chaddock. And I'm on Twitter as at Chaddock R. And you can find, you can search for our stuff on DriveThruRPG. That's generally our main sort of web presence, is just our DriveThruRPG page. I'm always on the Google Plus communities for Numenera and The Strange and everything like that.
Awesome. Awesome. Yeah. And I will have links to all that good stuff in the show notes. If you can't remember it, you can go there and just click. Well, thank you very much, Ryan.
Sure. Yeah, no problem. That was fun.
Well, that's going to wrap up episode 74 of GM Intrusions. If you would like to reach me, you can email me at gmintrusions@gmail.com. You can follow me on Google Plus, just search for Lex Starwalker. And also, please join the GM Intrusions Google Plus community, where you can talk about Cypher System games and role-playing games in general. You can also follow me on Twitter at Lex Starwalker. You can find Ryan Chaddock on Google Plus. Just search for Ryan Chaddock. That's C-H-A-D-D-O-C-K. And you can also find Ryan on Twitter at Chaddock R. And also go check out Ryan's many supplements for, let's see, Numenera, The Strange, and Fate, at the very least, on DriveThruRPG. And I will have a link to his DriveThruRPG page in the show notes at starwalkerstudios.com. If you enjoy GM Intrusions and you'd like to see it keep growing, going strong, please support the show if you would. One great way that you can do that is you can become a patron of the show and enjoy some cool little benefits and thank yous for doing so. You can find out more about that at patreon.com/GM Intrusions, or you can use the link in the show notes. And I want to send a big thank you and shout out to a few of my most devoted patrons, Philip Coffey, Derek Pounds, and Drew Wilson. Thank you guys. Couldn't do it without you. We also now have a donate button on the website at starwalkerstudios.com if you would prefer to do a one-time donation. And another great way that you can help out the show is to test run Audible Books with a free trial courtesy of GM Intrusions. And you can find out more about that on starwalkerstudios.com, or you can head on over to audibletrial.com/GM Intrusions. Finally, if you shop on Amazon, please use our referral link, which you will also find in the show notes. And finally, last but not least, another great way that you can help the show out and help the studio out is to tell your friends about GM Intrusions and our other great podcasts. So once again, I want to thank you very much for listening to GM Intrusions and downloading the show every week. And I want to thank you for your support. Once again, my name is Lex Starwalker, and this has been a GM Intrusion.
This has been a Starwalker Studios production, your source for quality gaming and hobby podcasts.
This episode's music provided by Stanko, Ish, Cloudwalker, Renfield, and Transboy. Please see the show notes for more details at starwalkerstudios.com/GM Intrusions.
GM Intrusions is made possible thanks to the support of listeners like you. Learn how you can become a patron of the show at patreon.com/GM Intrusions.
I'm awesome.